This is WJBC This Week.
We just thought that it was a heroic incident where this individual sacrificed himself for somebody else.
Well, I wasn't scared. I was a little nervous.
There are things we can do to make it better. We can't just throw up our hands and say, oh, no, we can't stop everything. So we can't change things that need to be changed.
We need to make sure that we're doing everything we can to protect America and to stop terrorism around the world.
It's too massive and there's too little time in this fiscal year to solve this budget crisis.
All right, let me avoid creating a headline for tomorrow's newspaper.
This is a little bit like getting a lump of coal in your stocking.
Welcome to WJBC This Week, where we look back at the top stories and interviews from the past week. I'm Eric Stock. On this week's program, we'll talk to a Bloomington woman who witnessed the bombing of Pearl Harbor 74 years ago this week. We hear from a local Muslim leader following Donald Trump's call to temporarily stop all Muslims from entering the U.S. The head of the Illinois Policy Institute explains why he thinks the state budget impasse is a good thing. Plus, author Travis Vogan discusses ESPN's rise and success and the worldwide sports leaders distancing itself from a documentary on concussions. That and more coming up. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. The bombing of Pearl Harbor 74 years ago this week was one of the darkest moments in American history, but one that's fading from our memories. There aren't many people still among us who experienced it firsthand. One Bloomington woman did. Barb Segoviano was living in Hawaii when the Japanese attacked. Segoviano relived the harrowing day and the days and weeks that followed when she talked with WJBC's Dan Sweeney this week.
Take us back to that Sunday morning, December the 7th, 1941. How old were you and what were you doing on that Sunday morning?
Well, I was 8 years old, and my father and was a Navy, in the Navy, a petty officer, chief petty officer, and we were stationed in Hawaii, and he had the duty the night before Pearl Harbor happened. So my mother was home. My sister and I had gone to 7 o'clock Mass, which was our church was just a few blocks from home, and we were supposed to go to my girlfriend's house for breakfast. And as we came out of church, my sister said, no, we're going to go home. And I said, no, we're not. We're going to, my girlfriend's name was also Barbara. She said, he said, she did, that we're going to go home to Mother. And, of course, that made me very unhappy. But we did go home to Mother, and she was surprised to see us because she thought we'd gone to my friend's house for breakfast. And we walked into the house, and all of a sudden we heard this rumbling. And in Hawaii, you leave your windows open most of the time, unless it's raining. And the little girl, Filipino girl next door, loved to roller skate, actually, is what it was in those days, on the hardwood floors, which made a lot of noise. And Mother said, oh, I think Pauline is already roller skating this early in the morning. Well, then it got louder and louder, so we went outside, and we saw the planes. If you went to see the Pearl Harbor movie, you see the planes coming in between the two mountains.
Sure.
Well, that's where we lived. We live in the Kalihi Valley area district, and we saw the planes coming. But in Hawaii, a lot of times on Sunday, the military had mock drills in the air, and so we weren't terribly surprised to see the planes coming. But the noise was louder, and there were more planes. And then they started, we could see where they were diving down, and that surprised us. Well, then we watched, we stood out there on the sidewalk outside the house, and we watched the bigger planes, which turned out to be the bombers, continue over our area and go on to Pearl. But the fighters remained in our area and started shooting. And we were on the sidewalk, and they had a plane come over our house and did machine gun on the sidewalk where we were standing. And he was low enough that you could even see the outline of the pilot in the plane. And my mother said, oh, my God, it's the rising sun, which, of course, to me at 8 years old didn't mean much. But it was the emblem of the Japanese on the side of the plane. So she took our hands and she grabbed them and we ran into the house and turned on the radio and we heard church music. But we knew that we were being attacked. And then pretty soon they said, stay in your house. We are being attacked by the Japanese. Take every available container that you have and fill with water because they were afraid of poisoning. And the reason they were attacking our area particularly was we had a huge water tower right just several blocks from our house. And that's what they were trying to eliminate. Because if you eliminate on an island the source of fresh water, you can really do severe damage to the civilian area. So anyway, we did. We put water in the bathtub, face bowl, kettles, pots, whatever we could. And then they said to take blankets and nail them to our windows, because even the slightest light in your house can be seen from the sky. And so we had to do that. We grabbed every blanket we had and put them at the windows. And then they said, go into the inner room of your house, a room that has rooms around it, because shrapnel can only go through one wall. And if you're in the bedroom and you're on the outer wall, you take a greater chance of being harmed. So we did that. Well, then my mother happened to think that the little lady behind us was only 21 years old. She had a six-week-old baby, and her husband was at sea. So we ran back and got her, and then we put blankets. We took mattresses off of our twin beds and put them in the hallway, which had rooms all the way around it. And we had flashlight, and we had radio. And we got in that room, and we stayed there all the rest of the day. That night, we heard machine gunning. We heard all this. And, of course, we thought by the time we woke up in the morning that we would be, you know, invaded by the Japanese. We were just sure we were going to be. And all night long, of course, we did some praying and some crying. And, of course, we were worried about our father. My dad had had the duty the night before, as I said earlier. And he had called the night before and said, I have the duty. He was on the submarine, the USS Norwalk. And he said, I'll be home at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, which would have been Pearl Harbor morning. So we knew that he was on his sub, and we were scared to death, of course, that he was going to be either injured or killed.
Was the sub anchored at Pearl Harbor?
Yes, it was. Okay. There were four submarines there. There were just four. I don't know the names of the other three, but the Norwalk was one of them. And so we didn't hear from Dad for weeks and weeks. Did not know if he was alive or dead. They didn't allow anybody to use the phones or anything, because in those days it was all just use of military. And we couldn't use any cars either. No phone and no cars. We were under military duty. The general of the army had taken over the civilian government. And so we had to do everything, of course, by the military rule. And we were told to go downtown to Honolulu, downtown, and get our vaccinations and to get our gas masks, which we did. And they called the children's gas masks Mickey Mouse gas masks, but they weren't Mickey Mouse. They were just small size.
Sure.
And wherever we went, we had to have it on our shoulder. And, of course, school was closed. We didn't get back to school for 3 weeks. Life was very different. They told us not to use the civilian grocery stores. Let the civilians do that. Of course, we were considered military family. And don't go to the grocery store. If you need anything, gather up together in one car and go to the what's the military? I can't think of the name.
The PX?
Commissary.
Yeah,
okay. Go to the commissary, all you military people, and get what you need. So one day, I guess it was 2 days after Pearl, my mother's friend, who was an Army wife, my mother did not drive, so this Army wife came by and wanted to know if she needed to go to the commissary, and Mom said, yes, we do. We need some things. So, of course, I got in the car with Mom and my sister, who was 12 at the time. She did, too. You didn't go anywhere without your kids for fear something would happen again. And anyway, we went on, and we had to go through Pearl, through the Navy base, to get to the commissary. And as we did, we passed the Arizona. And she was still on fire. The oil in the water was burning. The smell was atrocious. And I asked my mother, I was only 8, if you remember, I said, what is that smell, Mom? And she said, it's the burnt flesh. It was so prevalent and awful. And I learned later, while I was still there in Honolulu, that they had dug a huge, huge trench-like and put the bodies all in there together. They didn't have time to do single burials. And then, of course, later in the years, they were able to bring them back up and bury them singularly. But that was the only reason. Of course, they had to do that only because of the time element, but also because of the public health element. They had to have the bodies buried just as quickly as possible. And my dad told us later, when he was able to come home, after 3 weeks, he was able to come home for an afternoon, that the submarine was not hit per se. I mean, there was some machine gun bullets and such, but no torpedoes hit the submarines. And he said that as soon as they realized that the hour and 15 minutes of the attack was done, then he and his men, and of course the other officers too, went into the water and were helping bring the bodies, and many of them were still alive but struggling. And they helped to do that, to bring them in. And it didn't matter, my dad said at that time, what you were assigned to. You were a submariner, you were on the destroyer, you were on a battleship. No, battleships weren't there, excuse me. Anything like that. You all worked together. It didn't matter. If you were available, you went in and you pitched in. So anyway, when about 3 weeks had gone by, there was an officer that came to the door, and my mother answered, and he handed my mother my father's billfold. Well, needless to say, my mother let out a scream because she thought Dad was gone.
Yeah.
And he said, no, no. He said, Harry is alive, but he doesn't know when you and the girls are going to be evacuated. And there's papers in this billfold that he thinks you might have to have. So you take what you need, and which she did. And within a couple days after that, Dad did come home for an afternoon. Now, he and Mom talked, but they asked us girls to go out of the room. He didn't. You know, they didn't want us to hear the...
Boy, what a day that must have been.
Yes, it was.
Goodness, because you didn't know he was coming home, and then he's there.
Pardon me?
You didn't know that he was coming home. You didn't even know where he was, and there he is.
And see, he couldn't call us because he couldn't use the phone either.
Sure.
It was only for absolute emergencies, phone and car. And gas, of course, was being rationed for those who have to have it, and not for civilians. But I did skip over something that this is a hard thing for me to talk about.
Okay.
But, the breakfast lady, the girl that I was going to go have breakfast with, December 8th, the morning after the attack, we did get a paper still. It still had produced it, and it was at the door on December 8th. And we brought it in, and it had, of course, sketchy information, but information, at least letting some of us know what was happening. And... it had the death, and in the death was my girlfriend and her entire family.
Wow.
So if we had gone there and gone to have breakfast, my sister and I would not be here today. We do not know why she was so adamant that we don't go, and she doesn't know why.
Hmm.
So it just wasn't meant to be.
Boy.
Yeah.
Barb Segoviano is with us. She was at Pearl Harbor on Hawaii, on Oahu, when the Pearl Harbor attack happened. She was an 8-year-old youngster, and awful lot to be taking in as an 8-year-old, that's for sure. Leading up to Pearl Harbor, was there any idea that something like this was going to happen?
Yes, my father said there was, but I didn't know it until after the fact. But he and all of his cohorts in the Navy all felt that President Roosevelt was gearing toward it. They did, and especially after the attack. And they also felt that he knew the attack was going to be at Pearl Harbor. Now, how true that was, I don't know. But that's the way a lot of the sailors I know felt.
Barbara, when you were when you had that first glimpse of an airplane coming towards you,
yes.
Here it is, a bright, sunny, perfect Hawaiian Sunday morning. How far away were you when this plane began to come down and strafe towards where you were?
Very close. I mean, they did the sidewalk right in front of me and my sister and my mother. I mean, the bullets hit the sidewalk where we were, and that's when my mother let out the scream, "Oh, my God, it's the rising sun," which, of course, as I said, I didn't know it meant Japanese until we got in the house, and she told me. My sister did know, but I didn't. And, yeah, it was pretty. You could see the outline of the pilot. They were down that close.
Wow. And how long did it seem like that first wave of attacks? Because there were two waves. But
yeah.
How long did it seem it lasted?
That I really can't tell you for sure. But the whole total was 150.
Yeah.
An hour and 50 minutes.
Yeah.
And if they had decided to come back, they probably could have taken the island. and they opted not to.
That's what I was going to ask you, because I just saw a documentary last night or the night before on Pearl Harbor, and I didn't remember that there was actually a bulletin that went out over the airwaves that said there was a third attack underway at Pearl Harbor. And
strongly considered.
Yeah, and that they were afraid that now this is the land invasion that's coming in. And you guys were aware of that a little bit, weren't you? That's why you were taking all the precautions.
Yeah, we were. In fact, when we were in the middle hall, as I told you, we all felt and we heard the machine guns all night because there were spies. Hawaiian ones, Japanese ones, that were arrested the second and third day. And they knew of the attack. Of course, a little sidebar here, my mother's friend was a telephone operator. And she was one of the first ones to get the message over the phone that the Japanese were attacking. And she says to the Japanese operator next to her, "Oh, my God, we're being attacked by the Japanese." And the little operator said that wasn't supposed to happen until next Sunday.
Oh, my gosh. Are you kidding me?
Of course, they arrested her.
That was Pearl Harbor survivor Barb Segoviano with Dan Sweeney. You can hear the entire interview at WJBC.com. A Muslim leader in Bloomington Normal is calling for understanding among people of different faiths following a call by presidential candidate Donald Trump that all Muslims be banned from coming into the U.S., concept that a majority of Republicans support based on a new poll. WJBC's Terry James talked with Sharar Mufti this week.
If you watch cable news, if you listen to newscasts, it's Muslim, anti-Muslim this, anti-Muslim that coming out of especially one presidential candidate's mouth.
Thank you for inviting me here. I would say that we're concerned, just like every other American out there, about the rhetoric coming from some corners of the political sphere. I wouldn't say that it impacts our daily life, especially in Bloomington Normal or McLean County. We found our community to be very safe, very inclusive. Diversity and inclusion are main pillars that we hold dear. So we don't really foresee, or we have not really seen any issues within our community. But, you know, when you have rhetoric coming from one place, there might be some people who actually believe that. And that's our goal. We have to make sure that we bring the positive aspect forward.
How long have you lived in Bloomington Normal?
I've been here since 2005. My wife actually has been here since she was 2 years old. So our family, I would say, has been here since 1988.
And how big is the Muslim community in Bloomington Normal?
I would say it's quite large in terms of the demographics if you compare across with other communities in Illinois. It's surely not as large as Champaign because of the University of Illinois being there. But I would probably put our numbers at about 300 to 400 families.
When I hear the term the Nation of Islam, what does that mean?
So the Nation of Islam is a Islamic religious and political movement that has its roots in the United States. So typically, the mainstream Islamic community throughout the world do not include them in the Islamic faith. Their ideology is tailored towards United States, towards the plight of African Americans in the United States, and they derive, you know, a lot of their ideas from their leaders, which are based in the United States.
So is it fair to say that every member of the Nation of Islam is Muslim, but not every Muslim is part of the Nation of Islam?
I would say yes. Yeah. I mean, we as Muslims are inclusive of everyone who claims themselves to be Muslims. So, I mean, we are not the ones who can judge someone, you know, you're a Muslim, you're a Christian. So if someone says you're a Muslim, you know, we accept that. And yes, I would say that not all Muslims belong to Nation of Islam. Actually, I would say 90% of Muslims do not belong to Nation of Islam. It is not considered, Nation of Islam is not considered one of the main denominations of Islam.
Jihad. What is jihad?
jihad is an Arabic word that really means literally struggle. So it means struggle in terms of struggle and perseverance. So what it really means for us Muslims is we struggle within ourselves spiritually, try to stay on the correct path, do not lie, you know, do not cheat, do no harm to other fellow human beings, you know, worship how you're supposed to worship God, and, you know, say thanks and give charity and fast if needed and all that stuff. So that is really the main meaning of jihad. There are you know, other ways that jihad is portrayed. It could also mean armed struggle, but typically when that is the case, you have to have state actors and their specific type of guidelines in Islam that really apply, and you know, otherwise it's not really the case.
We're talking with Shayar Mufti. He's a local Muslim community member and the captain of the McLean County Diversity Project. Okay, so when you explain jihad there, it seems to be a positive thing, but when I listen to news reports, I hear them, for instance, the leader of ISIS who was killed, they call him Jihadi John, or they say an act of jihad, or some form of that word seems to always go with a negative person or someone who commits a negative act. So with your definition, do you understand my confusion there with how that lines up?
Absolutely, and I think that is the fact that it is a confusion. Sometimes words are used in a specific context and they actually become that. If we were talking about jihad 100 years ago, it would have been a different conversation. Now, I do accept that when someone says Jihadi John or when someone uses the word jihad, they automatically imply armed struggle. Now, what I do not agree with is jihad equals terrorism. However, most of the time, you know, when there is the notion of armed struggle and, you know, jihad mentioned, it can be equated to terrorism. For us, jihad in terms of armed struggle really means to defend oneself against oppression. So, for example, you know, there's a Muslim country that has been invaded without due cause, and they fight for their own survival. So that, to us, is the real armed struggle mentioned in jihad.
That was local Muslim leader Shayar Mufti with Terry James. Today's local news is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. As the state budget impasse drags on into its sixth month, a conservative think tank says this stalemate that has led to delayed payments to schools, local governments, and social service agencies all over the state is a good thing, or better than the alternative. John Tillman, CEO of the Illinois Policy Institute, talked with WJBC's Scott Laughlin and Colleen Reynolds this week.
So are you going to tell me that because the state isn't paying its bills, that's good for the state?
No, certainly that is not good. But one of the key questions when you're ill is what is the proper remedy to get you healthy for the long run, something that helps alleviate your symptoms temporarily or something that actually solves the illness that you're suffering from. And I would submit that the budget impasse is actually good in the sense that we have not yet seen a capitulation by the governor to the status quo that has been driving us to the precipice and really into the danger zone of fiscal insolvency for the state. The fact that we don't have a budget is actually a good thing. If we had a budget, it would mean the capitulation would have already happened. We would have had tax increases without the necessary structural reforms that the governor is proposing.
So you would like to see the governor just dig in and wait till the other side breaks?
No, I don't think that's the exactly how I'd phrase it. I want to wait until, you know, really want to get, when you come down to politics and how you pass policies through the legislature that benefits all of the people of Illinois, the poor and disadvantaged in particular, provides better retirement security for government workers whose pensions are at risk, and yet at the same time protects taxpayers who fund those retirements and fund all government services, you really have to try to take into consideration everyone's needs. And the bottom line is the legislators, particularly Democrat-controlled General Assembly, have to fear their own voters more than they fear Speaker Madigan or Senate President Carlton or the unions who fund Democrat elections. And once they get a little of that accountability from the voters coming a little closer to their mindset after the first of the year with an election on the horizon, I think we'll find an accommodation that gives each side a little something.
With so much debt in the pension fund and $6.7 billion in unpaid bills, aren't we just digging a hole deeper and deeper every day we don't have a budget?
No, because the budget is not the key part of this. The key part of all of this is how does the state generate revenues to pay down the debt you're talking about. You just mentioned $6.7 billion of unpaid bills that we've already incurred and then $100-plus billion of unfunded pension liabilities. The question for the state is how do you generate revenues beneficially to pay that all down? If you get a budget remedy that doesn't create growth in revenues, then we're going to keep digging the hole. What the governor's point is he wants to see Illinois become a high-growth state so that the economy throws off more revenues into the coffers to pay off the bills that you're referring to. And let me give it to you in simple terms. The bottom line is this. Right now, spending is growing faster than revenue growth. So every day that goes by, we are digging a bigger hole. The governor is saying we've got to get revenue growth to grow faster than spending. So he's trying to hold the line on spending to slow that spending growth down while trying to get structural reforms such as workers' comp reform, collective bargaining reform, unemployment insurance reform, prevailing wage reform, and of course you would like to see term limits. All of these things would slow down the growth of spending over time and allow the growth of revenues. Then you have a surplus and you can pay down the very bills that you're talking about. If you can make a budget deal that doesn't do that, then you're just digging the hole worse.
Talking with John Tillman, Illinois Policy Institute. I don't want to go back to something you said about the assembly needs to be more concerned about their constituents than they are Madigan. But Madigan controls their purse strings. And by that, I mean this guy's got a lot of power, with it a lot of money. And if these representatives that work for Madigan, and not necessarily the state of Illinois, don't get the money they need, they're not going to be able to help him. It's a vicious cycle. But you know what I'm saying? Because he deals with an iron fist.
Speaker Madigan controls the Illinois General Assembly, and particularly the House, through three things. Number one is he controls the money. He's the biggest fundraiser for political campaigns in the state, as you have pointed out. Number two, he recruits the talent, the people that are in office in the General Assembly and are among his 71 members were primarily recruited by Speaker Madigan over many years to get into those positions. So there's a sense of being beholden to him. And number three, not only does he control the money, he controls the political talent that runs the election campaigns for all these individual members. And that is why he has held control for so long. But the bottom line is, in the end, if the public becomes so upset, no matter how much money and political talent the speaker has, if the public becomes so upset with the results in Springfield that they begin to consider alternatives to Speaker Madigan's members, then those individual members may finally say, you know what, it's time for me to be more loyal to my constituents than to the political system that put me here. And I think that is where we're getting to. A good illustration of that is that there are 20 members in the Illinois House that are in districts that Governor Rauner won in 2014. So they have to make a decision. Do I vote with those people who put in Governor Rauner in my own district, or do I continue to vote on legislation the way the Speaker and the union funders of the Speaker's political power want me to vote? And I think that's what's going to be so interesting as we get after the first of the year and into the next session.
That was John Tillman of the Illinois Policy Institute with Scott Laughlin. ESPN has gone from being an obscure niche on cable television 3 decades ago to a multi-billion dollar enterprise. Travis Vogan wrote about the worldwide leader of sports in his new book, ESPN, The Making of a Sports Media Empire. He discussed the cable channel's rise to prominence with WJBC's Beth Wissman this week.
Let's talk about what it is that made ESPN unique and magic, as you might say, for sports reporting and sports storytelling and fans. They have a really special connection to their fans.
Yeah, and I think that that focus on branding has been kind of a central preoccupation of ESPN for a long time, trying to be more than just outlet for sports media, but they described it even at one point as trying to function as a hangout for fans or something that fans kind of identify with beyond just going there to get scores or news or whatever. And this is sort of reflected in, you know, SportsCenter's kind of sometimes snarky, sarcastic, mm-hmm. funny tone, some of the other kinds of programming it does, and it's sort of consistent focus on appealing to younger people, etc. So yeah, the brand and the branding operations have been in a lot of ways just as important as the fact that ESPN is a cable outlet or started as just a cable outlet that devoted, you know, all of its attention to sports.
Well, and that in itself, 1979, this launched that mm-hmm. year on cable, and cable was operating and offering opportunities for niche marketing, and so focusing on yeah. one type of area, whereas the networks were not really able to do that. Sure. Was ESPN the first to do it for sports?
Well, it was the first to devote itself entirely to sports, but it wasn't the first cable network that was emphasizing sports. There was, USA. In fact, HBO's first material that it aired was a hockey game, and it really kind of HBO really kind of got off the ground through carrying the Thriller in Manila, the Muhammad Ali fight.
Yeah.
So there were other cable outlets that were emphasizing sports and that were using sports to build an audience, but ESPN was the first that devoted itself entirely to sports.
And they've done it very well. And you mentioned the branding. You know when you see an ESPN production that you're watching ESPN. You can feel it.
Don't
it's tangible.
That.
No, they don't. They do a great job of that. But even just the personality.
Yeah, there is a kind of feel. There's a sort of style. And that style, I think, nowadays, is something that other sports media outlets have kind of taken up. And so in a way, that style that was sort of specific to ESPN initially has kind of become one of the dominant frameworks through which sports television is produced and created. And you can see, you know, a lot of people kind of trying to or aspiring toward that standard that they've created in the industry.
ESPN also not long ago testing some new waters in journalism, if you will, with sports. They did an investigative report that started research into concussions in the NFL in 2012. They partnered with the PBS series Frontline in producing the documentary called League of Denial. And some had suggested that partnership was giving ESPN a new level of credibility. But then, of course, ESPN pulled its brand name from that documentary just weeks before its premiere, in part due to the NFL pressuring ESPN to disassociate from the documentary. And we'll talk about the documentary in a few moments, but that's not uncommon. Sports is interesting. From my vantage point as a former news director, it was often that I had to be the one who would step in with a sports director or a sports reporter whose first instinct was to protect their friend, their partner, their team that they covered, because there are personal close relationships that develop between sports reporters and athletes and athletics directors, etc. So understandably, the NFL used its leverage to try to use those personal relationships and threats, you know, with ESPN not to air what was a pretty damning documentary about their lack of work and effort to help athletes and who had concussions.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And with sports outlets like ESPN, it is different from sort of regular news outlets, because ESPN is paying the NFL close to $2 billion a year, that's with a B, to cover and to air Monday Night Football and to get other content. So they have this partnership, a really kind of valuable and expensive partnership, and it's in their best interest to, you know, nurture that relationship, because the NFL might decide not to award them rights if they upset that institution. But on the other hand, ESPN is claiming to be a source of kind of reliable, incredible, and responsible journalism. And sometimes those claims to journalistic responsibility and those business relationships butt up against each other, and you get some, disappointing results for those of us who care about journalism and those of us who would like to, learn more about these organizations and whatnot that we follow as sports fans. And nobody, you know, it's ESPN never admitted that the NFL pressured them to remove their brand from the League of Denial documentary. The NFL never admitted to requesting it, but, you know, it doesn't take a genius to see that kind of relationship in action and wonder, you know, why wouldn't ESPN, which has been, you know, producing documentaries of different types and trumpeting its status as a site of reliable journalism, want to partner with Frontline, you know, just kind of a standard bearer of television journalism, to create this really interesting documentary, one that wound up winning a Pulitzer, actually, so it was pretty good. Or not a Pulitzer, a Peabody, I'm sorry. And, so those partnerships kind of butt up against its claims to journalistic reliability and in ways that are disappointing, but in ways that are important to point out, you know, since ESPN is such a powerful force in how we tend to experience sports in the United States.
That was author Travis Vogan with Beth Wissman. The Weekend News is next. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. Time now for the Weekend News. A Bloomington police officer who was fired after he grabbed a special needs student by the throat in Stevenson Elementary School 5 years ago is getting $322,000 in compensation from the city. A court ruling earlier this year allowed Officer Scott Oglesby to return to the job and receive compensation for time missed. He will be able to use unspent sick leave up until July, at which time he will retire from the force. Unit 5's high schools were two of just 22 schools across the country to be awarded $100,000 grants through State Farm's annual Celebrate My Drive campaign. WJBC's Adam Stasinski reports.
This year's campaign asks schools to raise awareness for the Drive 2 and 2 initiative, meaning two eyes on the road and two hands on the wheel. Normal Community High School Associate Principal Nikki Maurer.
It's pretty amazing. I mean, especially right now with all of the budgetary constraints that we have in the state and the country, really, especially with education, it's huge to have this amount of money that we can do some great things in our school to help our kids.
Maurer says they hope to use some of the funds to reopen NCHS's Academic Support Center during the day. That's a program which offers students a place to find help on their schoolwork during study hall and lunch. Adam Stasinski, WJBC and WJBC.com.
The Citizens Utility Board is asking the Illinois Commerce Commission to reconsider rate increases that will allow Ameren to hike typical residential natural gas bills up to $6 per month and electricity bills up to $7 per month. Cub spokesman Jim Chilson.
Cub is glad that the company didn't get all that it wanted, but we still think it got more than it proved it actually needed. You know, for central and southern Illinois consumers, this is a little bit like getting a lump of coal in your stocking.
The new rate increases take effect next month. Congressman Rodney Davis says restrictions the U.S. House has approved to tighten the visa waiver program are reasonable.
We have to look at our visa programs. Look at the K-1 visa program that the terrorist out in San Bernardino came in on, a fiancé visa. I mean, these are existing programs that need to be identified as how do we stop these things from happening.
The existing program allows citizens of 38 countries to be in the U.S. for up to 3 months without a visa. The legislation would require visas for anyone who's been in Iraq or Syria in the previous 5 years. Additional revenue has been part of House Speaker Mike Madigan's preferred budget solution from the start, but exactly how high would the income tax rate have to go? Madigan gave some indication in a speech to the City Club of Chicago this week.
All right, let me avoid creating a headline for tomorrow's newspaper. And say that a good place to begin, would be the level we were at before the income tax expired,
which was 5%. Illinois is now in its sixth month without a state budget. And Bloomington's fire chief is calling a local man a hero. WJBC's Terry James says the man used his fire extinguisher to save the life of another person.
Fire Chief Brian Moore says it happened Thanksgiving Day on the ninth floor of North Woodhill Tower.
So we just thought that it was a heroic incident where this individual sacrificed himself for somebody else. Luckily, there was no injuries that day.
David Cummings was able to limit the fire to the mattress and some bedding.
Well, I wasn't scared. I was a little nervous. I didn't get scared until the fire was out and I got out of there and I got done talking to everybody.
Cummings received extensive fire training during a previous job. Terry James, WJBC and WJBC.com.
Up next, the week to come. This is WJBC This Week. Welcome back to WJBC This Week. It's time to take a look ahead at the week to come. On Monday, Bloomington City Council will consider creating a new tax increment financing district on Empire Street. On Tuesday, the McLean County Board is expected to fill a vacancy on its board caused by the departure of Sonny O'Connor. On Thursday, the Bloomington Normal Economic Development Council will host BN by the Numbers, which will include a talk from a consultant discussing development on the I-39 corridor. This has been WJBC This Week. To listen to this week's program again, go to the WJBC.com podcast page. I'm Eric Stock.